Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. I'm sitting alongside president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Bob Hoban. Today we are talking about whether or not the cannabis market is recession-proof, and we are joined by author, managing director of Benzinga Cannabis, and Forbes contributor, Javier Hase. Javier, thank you for joining us today.
Please, thank you for having me. It's an honor.
And you are down in Argentina right now. Give us a sense and our listeners of what it is like in Argentina today.
So to be honest, I think I was mentioning this a little bit, the conversation with you guys. Things are pretty okay down here. And I'm pretty proud of how the government has acted and responded to such crisis. 2 weeks ago, the president declared a mandatory national federal quarantine, which basically means that people cannot leave their homes unless they need to, which basically, you know, the things you can do is go for groceries, go to the pharmacy, period. So unless you're employed in what are considered essential jobs, you know, healthcare, security, or for instance, working at, say, supermarkets, you cannot go out of your house, period. And honestly, it's working out. You know, the spread of the virus is relatively contained. It's not particularly fast. We aren't seeing very high death tolls. And generally, there's no sense of massive panic, right? The president we have took office in December. And I got to say, I'm very positively impressed with how he handled things. We often become accustomed around the world to see presidents act in a non-presidential way. And what I saw here was, you know, a guy acting like president, right? Not out of touch, but not just too colloquial, right? And calm, but also at the same time, you know, being clear as to what the penalties would be for anyone who broke the quarantine, and how it would be enforced, and explaining, you know, that a few dunces, if you will not jeopardize 45 million people. So honestly, it's something that is working. One of the things that is, to me, you know, most heartwarming, and this is kind of anecdotal, but every night for the past 15 or 16 days at 9 p.m., every person will go out to their balconies and for 5 minutes straight clap and shout and play music to recognize the work of healthcare workers.
That's really cool.
And the federal government has given them a bonus. And, you know, people are committed to now supporting all their claims. And you know, public health care is a big thing here. So, honestly, I'm happy with the, you know, response to a crisis of this magnitude.
That's really heartwarming to hear, actually, especially as we've had a number of international guests on the Hoban Minute podcast, and not all of them have quite had that to say. So we're very happy to hear that, and very glad that you are in a place that is safe and is doing well during this unprecedented pandemic. So Javier, I put the question to you: recession proof, as you look at the U.S. cannabis industry and the international cannabis industry, do you see it as recession proof? I know I saw a article recently that said marijuana stocks are outperforming the S&P recently in the wake of all of this. So tell us your thoughts on all this.
So, I mean, to me, marijuana being recession proof, is not new. You know, it's pretty intuitive. People love their weed. Medical users need their cannabis, and they can't stop medicating, no matter what the economic situation is. As long as they can afford it, they will sacrifice other things before their medication. And recreational users usually just, love their weed. People are passionate about the plant. They're passionate about its effects. So in that sense, it's not news, but it has become very clear and evident in recent weeks, the magnitude or how deep this runs. On the market side, we've seen 2 weeks of relative strength compared to the S&P. Today was a particularly bad day for stocks, and things happen. But on that side, I'm thinking, and this is what I'm thinking just right now, this is off the top of my head, but it's not as hard to outperform the S&P after the terrible month that cannabis stocks had prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, right? So it's one of these things where there's nowhere to go but up. So suddenly we saw certain stocks that I would rather not mention them, but certain stocks trade up, big stocks up to like 150%, right? But that's because they were pretty beat up. But I don't know. What did you think?
Well, you raise an interesting point, which is that people are passionate. You have medical patients who need access, and these have been deemed dispensaries, I'm thinking right now, have been deemed essential services. And yet they are excluded from this stimulus package that was signed into law last week. Does that surprise you, Javier, or do you see that as being...
No. Does it surprise you? I mean, I honestly was surprised to see how surprised people were, how many emails and pitches and responses, I got from people saying, we are disappointed. It's like, why? Why were you expecting a government that deems a substance federally illegal and a Schedule I drug to include it in an economic stimulus package? Of course, I consider it wrong. I definitely think it should be. But it came as no surprise. I would have been very surprised if it was included in the stimulus package, because then it would be just conflicting, with every existing regulation.
So I guess that raises the next point, which is, are we getting any closer to those change in regulations from your perspective? Do you think that this pandemic, a lot of people, as you've pointed out, they saw it as an opportunity for, maybe this is going to make the federal government take some action. Maybe they're going to expedite, whether it's the Safe Banking Act or legalization, just starting to take it more seriously. Do you not really see it that way? Do you see this as just, it's kind of on the back burner for now, and you don't really see this as being kind of an impetus to move forward legislatively?
I believe it could, and it's likely it does help advance legalization. But again, I think it's more of a general shakeup, if you will, of how we conceive things. To give you an example, but one of the things that I've been discussing with family and friends down here in Argentina in relation to how America is dealing with the pandemic is how it will or could benefit, for instance, campaigns like, say, Bernie Sanders did, where he's talking about universal healthcare, right? And suddenly, a lot of Americans who are currently uninsured or underinsured, and even Americans who are insured, but, will probably realize that suddenly the proposal or the idea of having some kind of universal healthcare is not as insane as many would like to think, right? So, and this is just an example. I'm not advocating for or against it. I personally think it should be, but that's, you know, besides this discussion. But this crisis will probably change the way we think about many things, and that might include cannabis. And one of the main pieces among people more inclined to the economic or financial side of cannabis is that many of the state governments and even maybe the federal government will look at cannabis as a way to cover up for many of the, you know, let's call them potholes created by this crisis once it's over. So, you know, that's the standing thesis. There's discussions also around bonds. So the result, of course, as anyone will tell you, the famous "I don't have a personal ball" kind of thing, does apply here. But I don't see how all of this would not generate at least some kind of change.
You make an excellent point, Javier, and I think that when it comes down to it, the fact of the matter is that this, as a commercial regulated industry, comes mm-hmm. through this crisis. It definitely, the fact that it's here, along for the ride, and recognized as such, and not simply put off into the corner. Although arguably it's been done as it relates to the stimulus package. We can get into that here in a moment. But let's talk for a moment about how this impacts the financial resources, the capital available to the industry. As I look at the cannabis industry, I call the cannabis industry sort of has two sides in my mind. Legally speaking, it's the marijuana side and it's the industrial hemp side. And we saw the marijuana dollars begin to dry up as they were derived through the Canadian capital markets. That began to happen last year. Although right now I'm seeing in our practice over the last 2 weeks an enormous drive towards our private equity fund clients to be really aggressive with their acquisitions, almost in the same vein that they were over the past two mm-hmm. or 4 years, on the heels of the Canadian influx of capital, although it's much smarter, back to business fundamentals. Then on the industrial hemp side of the industry, we've seen a lot of things sort of be refocused to where it should have been refocused or focused in the first place. If I had a nickel for every client I told over the last 3+ years to not invest in cannabis industrial hemp extraction, I'd have a huge mm-hmm. pile of nickels. And most of those clients over the last 2 weeks have been calling back, said, "Bob, we didn't listen to you. We invested in extraction. It's just all for naught. It was a waste of our money. What should we look at next?" And we kind of look at the idea of what's next. Hemp is a commodity. Hemp is an industry. CBD or non-psychoactive cannabinoids, they've only been merely ingredients. How do you see this shaken out with that refocus? Does this put more of an impetus on the global food supply chain, which indeed will then bring more mainstream dollars into industrial hemp? How do you see this thing shaking out?
And let's break it down a little bit, because, you know, one thing that stuck with me from the very first moment you started discussing this last topic was I was thinking about the conversations I was having with my colleagues at Benzinga. And we have about, say, 35, 40 people who work in cannabis initiatives, but then the rest of the people at the company don't. And they're not, like, looking at cannabis stock as closely as I am, right? Like doing this every day or as you are. So when we first started talking about coronavirus, you know, at the time it was not even COVID, you know, the way we talked about it, everyone was thinking which stocks will benefit. And everyone was thinking about Netflix and Amazon and, you know, stay at home brands. And it came to, you know, as a surprise to many to see the spike in demand for cannabis, right? Of course, by now, people who are in the cannabis industry are fed up and tired of hearing every company brag about their sales spike because, yeah, whatever, everyone is selling more. you know. But it has been interesting, and a lot of, as you say, mainstream investors are taking notes. But then you went into hemp, right? And as you say, that's a commodity. And my thesis has always been the same. It's not innovative, but it's held it for 5-6 years, and it hasn't changed. And it's, you know, who's the largest producer today for industrial hemp? Isn't it China, right? Like, these sorts of, as you mentioned, agricultural commodities will definitely not drive premiums, will definitely, you know, not drive huge margins. And even, as you say, the extraction of cannabinoids will not be a high margin activity either, right? It's going to be a race to the bottom, and whomever can produce it at the lowest cost or, you know, a decent quality and decent price will come out a winner. And that will probably not be people in the United States where salaries are 10 times what there are, like, everywhere else, even Europe, right? So, I mean, starting to break that down. But as you say, it's interesting to see how many of the mainstream investors are now taking note of the dynamics of the industry and starting to understand a lot more where opportunity lies. And you know, starting to be a little bit less fearful when it comes to investing in things that are not, you know, the safe haven offered, and quote unquote safe haven offered by industrial hemp, which, you know, is federally legal and pretty much accepted. And, you know, one can argue it's not even about the cannabinoids, but about the fabrics or about the foods or about the oils or about, you know, the fuels. So there's always, there has been a lot more of an, you know, friendly approach from investors to hemp. And I do see that changing now. And that's why I brought that first point about sales up. Not because I find it interesting anymore, but because every mainstream media outlet has reported on 200-300% sales spike during this crisis. And people are starting to understand, you know, the value of the industry and product. And even many investors, I assume, who don't consume cannabis or maybe even, you know, see it in a negative light, are even, you know, starting to accept the fact that, going back to our initial point, people love their weed.
That they do.
Well, Javier, I'm wondering what's on the horizon for international cannabis. I'm specifically thinking about Latin America. I mean, if we look at it, we've seen Mexico come pretty close. Now that may be on pause, obviously, because of coronavirus. We also saw Brazil, take a pretty big step forward in recent months. I wonder if you would tell us what excites you the most. Maybe it's in Argentina, maybe it's in other Latin American countries, but what do you see as the big opportunities down south?
I mean, honestly, I'm excited about the region, and I have been very excited for a while. A friend of mine and myself came up with this project, you know, to release or have this sort of Spanish language information portal. And the timing was never right. And suddenly now, as the system finally started to catch on in Latin America, it felt right. You can follow us, and we'll include a little mention somewhere in the podcast for sure. But, you know, I'm excited about the general potential of the region. It's a pretty cannabis-friendly region. But most systems have taken a lot to be actually implemented. Right? Everyone was talking about Colombia, and we've been talking about Colombia, it feels like forever. You know, but the sales have been very slow. I think last week, for the first time, a company announced that it would be allowed to sell medical cannabis and preparations, and not just cosmetics, because before that, everyone was producing a lot of cannabis, for instance, in Colombia, and I'm talking tons, and they couldn't use them for anything. You know, they could put them into some creams, but, you know, all this potential for exports and all the, you know, expected internal demand and blah, 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 didn't play out as expected, right? So I am particularly excited about the region now because only now, you know, we're seeing the region really open up. Peru implemented, you know, started sales 3 or 4 months ago. Brazil passed legislation 4 months ago. Uruguay changed its laws to be more medical friendly 4 months ago, right? We've seen the first studies, you know, like clinical studies and trials come out of Argentina only 3-4 months ago, right? And it seems like, you know, it's Latin America in many ways moves together as a region, even if it's not coordinated. Things just catch on, right? As an example, there was this like freestyle rap league that became very popular in Argentina 2 years ago. And the following year, 1 year ago, suddenly it was in every country in Latin America with 1 million, 2 million followers and 5 million views per battle, and they do this every week around the continent, right? So things seem to catch on fast. And again, it's not like it's a coordinated effort, but, you know, look at the coincidences of the last few months, how almost every country has moved to a certain degree, right?
Well, we've seen just the different models come out of the different places across LATAM as well, and you know that's extremely interesting. And you make an excellent point about how things just sort of catch on. And you know the claims that come out of Colombia, I still believe Colombia will be a major player in world supply in the mm-hmm. cannabis industry going forward. But the claims and the reports you see coming out of there now are largely press release driven for publicly traded dollar investments. And unfortunately they're shipping to themselves. They're testing logistics and claiming victory for commercial sales and commercial readiness. Huh. And unfortunately we haven't seen that on a terrific scale, but we're running short on time here. And I did just want to touch on one more thing before we do run out of time. And that is the World Health Organization. I was in Vienna, Austria, the committee on narcotics in December of 2018, and that was on the heels of the World Health Organization coming out very strongly with its recommendations concerning cannabidiol and certain ways that it would recommend treating the cannabis plant. And then, of course, the Committee on Narcotic Drugs punted. They effectively went in, said, we're not going to discuss cannabis at this point in time. The people that were there, everybody was extremely disappointed. Several of us gave our presentations. They were well received and moved on. And they kind of expected the same thing to occur this year, not the delay mm-hmm. part of it, but a decision to be made. And all of a sudden, we've got this delay. How do you characterize what's happening there and what global political play would you perceive is occurring? Or is this really just processing information and coming out with a sound policy?
Actually, I've been wanting to flip the script for a while in this conversation and ask what you, Robert, think about this, especially when it was, you know, when it came to international topics, because you're one of the most knowledgeable people in the United States and really have an international focus, which most people sadly lack. And, you know, it's fair because America is a big enough market. It's a massive market. It's the largest in the world. So, you know, focusing on it is not a stupid move. But you are very internationally focused. We've already went through, you know, into that. But, you know, you're the legal expert here. One thing I've read, and, you know, I've read a lot of different interpretations of this, and one of my favorite writers is Alfredo Pascual, and he argued this was a good thing, right? So do you see it as a good or a bad thing that it wasn't discussed or decided upon now?
Well, I think there's several thoughts I have in this regard. First and foremost, as it relates to criminal justice reform, I think that the United Nations needs to segment out its treatment of this plant from a policy perspective as it relates to criminal justice reform measures and then substantive legal, commercial, regulatory matters. And it refuses to do that to date, because certainly from a criminal justice reform standpoint, there should be a uniform policy that trickles down to governments around the world. While the United States certainly respects the United Nations, it does not place the United Nations on a mantle like so many countries around the world, particularly the European countries, do in terms of its guidance and its setting the standard for how laws and policies should react. So from a criminal justice standpoint, there should be some sort of declaration of policy. From a science, from a medicine, from a controlled substance and policy perspective overall, unfortunately, what I'm seeing is that the folks that have been driving policy reform at the United Nations have been doing so for decades and decades and decades, and they've largely been ineffective. But they've also sort of run out of their competency, and I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean that as a matter of fact. We now are facing a global commercial regulated commercial industry. This is no longer simply about what policy would be the best to effectuate social change, criminal justice reform, et cetera. This is about bringing in a new set of influencers to the United Nations that can work side by side with the folks that have been working there for so long and actually have that impact from a commercial perspective. That perspective is lacking. And because of that, the lobbyists, and there are lobbyists at the United Nations like there are at every other governmental level around the world, they don't put a lot of stock in what the folks, the activists that have been driving this discussion for years, they don't put stock in what they have to say. I wouldn't say they go so far as ignoring them, but what that means is the United States then drives the agenda. I hate to put it that way, but it's unfortunately true. So that's what
it is. It is. You know, America has always dictated, especially on drug policy, how the rest of the world acts. And unfortunately, in many senses, America is not very responsive to entities with no power of, let's call it, enforcement. Right? So even if the UN came out with recommendations, you know, likeliness of adoption, I'd say, is 50-50. But here's my question to you, and you're saying this about UN. And now, how does, you know, Guterres's leadership play into all of this, right? Like, we have this guy who was supposedly very progressive when it came to drug policies, who had an impressive track record in Portugal. So, like, what's up with that?
Well, no, that's an excellent point, right? And it looks at how it starts with a criminal justice change, and then how that affects social change, instead of just trying to take it all and do it in one step. And that sort of goes back to my comment, what I said before, is I think it is a bit premature because there is no common definition of what the commercial global cannabis industry is. Is it medical? Is it adult use? Is it CBD? Is it a combination of all of the above? Do you regulate the plant by its uses? Do you try to force a uniform policy across the world? Because every part of the world has legalized this plant in some form or fashion, but for very, very, very different reasons and for based on very, very different policies. Some, you know, medicinal, some social justice-based, some economic, some a combination of all of the above. So there is no way for the United Nations to come out with a recommended or suggested pathway for governments to follow except for just rescheduling. And if rescheduling is all we're going to talk about right now, rescheduling hurts this industry tremendously, the over-the-counter marijuana industry. Rescheduling, in my opinion, would simply send a message to pharmaceutical companies and agencies of the government that work with approving specific drugs for specific purposes that this stuff, cannabinoids, combinations, formulas that include cannabinoids and terpenes, that those things need to be done by pharmaceutical companies and driven through a drug model. When instead, they need to consider this from three distinct policy lanes: pharmaceutical, nutraceutical or nutraceutical, and then food and supplements. Those three lanes define the consumables for humans from the cannabis plant. And until you divide it into those three lanes and come up with three distinct commercial-based regulated policies, and their head's not even there. They're not even thinking of things that way because they're not being fed that kind of leadership, that kind of guidance or framework, because the folks that have influence right now don't think that way. They want to see reform around the plant that reverberates through criminal justice, social justice, and makes the plant more available to people that need it for whatever reason they need it for. That's where they start, and that's where they effectively end, when it's so much more complex than that. But if you look at through those three windows, then there's a pathway there. They just don't seem to have that perspective right now. So from that perspective, I would suggest that it is premature. It's helpful that the World Health Organization and scientific-backed organizations that have great reputations around the world are coming out and saying, yeah, we shouldn't be afraid of cannabis. Here's why it's good, and here's the places that we should be concerned, or at least careful. But that only is one small fraction of what forms the basis for a multi-billion dollar, soon to be tens and tens of billions of dollars of an industry that's global in scope, with international governments all over the world participating. So, I mean, Eric, we can talk about this topic all day long.
Well, I was going to say, Javier, you have, man, you really have been a conduit for just incredible conversation, and we absolutely need to get you on here again. We haven't even had a chance to touch on your career as a rapper and some of the highlights there. So we're out of time, unfortunately. This go around.
We'll discuss it next time. I want to throw out one little shout out, and it's not for a company or anything. It's just something that popped up to my mind during Robert's last part of the conversation. Tomorrow, Thursday, April 2nd, is World Autism Awareness Day. And we're distracted by COVID. But, you know, if there's a day to remember this, I don't know, consider donating or supporting an organization of your choice. Just, you know, kind of things to be mindful about. You know, the world doesn't stop turning, and people don't stop suffering from other ailments.
Absolutely. Well, we thank you for bringing that up. Thursday, April 2nd, World Autism Awareness Day. Javier, thank you so much. It's been an honor to talk to you, and we can't wait to have you on again soon, my friend.
Thank you very much. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you very much. Much appreciated. Bye-bye.
Fantastic.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Hoban Minutes special series on coronavirus and cannabis. You can head on over to hoban.law for more information on this podcast or the Hoban Law Group. If you have any ideas for subjects that we should be covering or any questions you want to pose to Bob or myself, shoot us an email at media@hoban.law. And stay tuned for the next episode on the special series, Coronavirus and Cannabis.